From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, Governor Whitmer's update on Michigan's COVID-19 case surge and the creation of a health disparities task force.
This virus has shined a light on the staggering health disparities Black Michiganders have faced long before COVID-19 ever hit our state.
Details coming up. Also, as many call for the renaming of Detroit's Cass Tech, we explore the controversial life and legacy of its namesake, Lewis Cass.
He was instrumental in essentially the removal of the indigenous peoples of Michigan.
Then, a conversation about how to better meet the social needs of seniors during the pandemic and beyond.
There's a tremendous reluctance on the part of many older adults to discuss loneliness, mental health, falls, risk, fears of falling.
All that coming up on today's edition of Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today, older adults who are especially vulnerable to serious and sometimes fatal complications of COVID-19. Many of them have had to physically isolate, whether at home or in assisted living. That isolation certainly does pose other risks.
Older adults, already many of them experience social isolation, even in pre-COVID times. And this is sort of, you know, put the gas pedal down and we're ramping up to 100 miles per hour.
We're going to talk to an elder care researcher about some of the mental and physical health challenges that seniors are facing right now. But first, Governor Gretchen Whitmer today addressed the state with a warning about the latest coronavirus numbers. Michigan has been ticking upward in its infection rate after several weeks of stasis. Now, Governor Whitmer says the state is in danger of ending up right back where we started in March and April. Rick Pluta is Lansing Bureau Chief for Michigan's public radio stations. He joins us now. Hi, Rick.
Hello.
Is it me, or when the governor was making her comments today, did it sound like she was making a really specific address to young people?
I think that was certainly part of her message, that now that the weather's warm, that there are places for people to go out and gather, that there does seem to be a pretty large cohort of late teens and 20-somethings who are, you know, out in the sun and playing and doing so in close quarters and without masks.
For sure. So we heard her say that masks should be worn and should be worn in gatherings most especially,
right,
and really, really should be worn if you're indoors with anyone.
She even made a joke out of it, saying that this might make you angry, but if necessary, just wear a mask that says, "I hate masks."
If we should say that masks are mandatory in Michigan as per the governor's order, but enforcement of that has been a little bit hit or miss depending on where you live in the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that basically the state has been relying on local health agencies and police officers and, you know, retailers and restaurants and places where people congregate to enforce the orders, with very mixed results. And we have seen a couple of local police departments start to step in, but it's not a place where anyone is anxious to go. The governor said as much today, but she also strongly hinted that we may see in coming days the state rolling out some enforcement mechanisms.
Definitely. Also an ask from Dr. Khaldun to keep the gathering small, mm-hmm, but even though there was no overt call for a lockdown today. Rick, how much pushback has the governor been getting in recent weeks on the latest round? Obviously, things loosened quite a bit at the end of June and early July, but do you sense that she's still facing the same kinds of political pressure for COVID restrictions as she has, say, in the month of May?
Well, I would say almost exactly the kind of political pressure, and we still see, this may change as time goes on, but that overall people do support masking and distancing in order to help prevent the spread of COVID-19, although the infections have not been evenly apportioned throughout the state. And we're seeing, you know, places where masking has been largely complied with, that we're seeing a flattening in the rates. But in places where the public seems more skeptical, we're West Michigan, for example, that we're starting to see something of an incline in those numbers.
Right. So in other news, the governor announced additional action on the health care disparities that have become so tragically undeniable because of COVID. And the lieutenant governor, Garland Gilchrist, was with her, and he noted he's lost 23 people that in his social circle to the virus. That's just astonishing and horrible at the same time.
Horrible, astonishing in some respect, not astonishing in others, that we've known for a long time, and the lieutenant governor and the governor and the state's public health director, who's also African-American, all referred to this, that we've known for a long time that there are health disparities between people of color versus, you know, what we see in the state's population writ large. Just the COVID-19 crisis has put them into very stark relief, and they're kind of saying this is an opportunity to tackle that disparity.
Rick, refresh my memory. Hadn't the governor announced some measures to start to address this problem before the COVID pandemic hit?
The lieutenant governor has been put in charge of a health disparities task force that's working up some ideas and recommendations on how to address that. But, now this has been put in the form of an executive directive that, as a part of the health professional licensing and relicensing process, that you have to have been through an approved implicit bias training program. Although we don't know exactly what will be in that program, those are being worked up by state government panels right now.
Let's listen to a little bit of what Governor Whitmer had to say.
This virus has shined a light on the staggering health disparities Black Michiganders have faced long before COVID-19 ever hit our state.
And we should point out that it's while the health disparities certainly do exist within the African-American population, that it's not confined to that, that we see that in the Hispanic-American population, Native American populations, that there are a lot of disparities in minority groups.
Rick, you've been at a number of these press conferences that the governor has given throughout the course of the pandemic. Would you say the tone has changed at all over the past few months?
Yeah, it depends a lot on the moment, and I don't want to pretend that it's been a glide in any particular direction. That there's a tendency to note but not necessarily celebrate improvements because the situation remains so dire. And like the governor and the Janae Caldoun said today, that we're seeing some regress in terms of what's happening with COVID-19 in Michigan, and that's why she said that we may need to clamp down again, reenact some of these restrictions, and maybe even give create more tools for enforcement of masking and distancing.
Was there any discussion today of exactly what the state or local authorities could or should do to enforce the wearing of masks? I mean, could we be looking at citations or tickets?
More hints than specifics, that we are seeing a very small number of municipalities and counties that are starting to issue citations. But so far, we really haven't seen that. It's relied largely on voluntary compliance. And the governor said today that we may see soon in the next few days that the state may add some enforcement mechanisms alongside the orders that the governor's already issued. I mean, we should point out that violating an executive order does carry penalties. It's a misdemeanor. So it's not like law enforcement agencies can't issue citations. It's just that by and large so far they've chosen not to.
Yeah, and you got to wonder how that's going to go over. There are counties in Michigan where local sheriffs, for example, have said that if there are gun regulations that they feel are contrary to the Second Amendment, that they would not enforce them if the state passed them. And maybe they would take a similar view on some of the COVID rules.
Oh, we know that because some local law enforcement officials have said exactly that. And in some cases, there are local governments that have said, we'd actually like to see some specific penalties outlined beyond what's already in state law regarding violating executive orders so that we can use this as not just a specific enforcement tool, but also a warning that something that they can show people who are in retail spaces, for example, that are violating the order that, owners and personnel can go, look, here, we've got it in paper. We've got a newspaper clipping. We've got an official government order that says specifically you have to do this or else, and hoping that maybe that will take some of the tribulation out of trying to get customers to abide by these.
Sure. There was a time not that long ago when Republican leaders in the legislature were really pushing back on the governor's executive authority and some of the decisions she was making around the pandemic. I feel like it's been a little quiet on that front lately.
It has been quiet. Now, these questions about the governor's authority are in court right now, so they're being litigated, and that does tamp down discussion and debate to a degree. But I mean, there's certainly not much argument anymore about whether or not there should be distancing requirements and requirements to wear masks, regardless of how Republicans in the legislature might feel about that in private.
Obviously, we know that the case rates have been very different depending on what county you're in Michigan. But do you get the sense that many members of the legislature of either party are starting to get a handle on the statewide grasp that COVID has on Michigan?
It depends on who you talk to. That right now, we've seen the biggest cluster of cases in southeast Michigan, but we're seeing increases in rates of infection growth happening in northern Michigan. So it is a problem that even though there are different permutations of it, that exists statewide.
Rick Pluta covers politics and government for Michigan Radio and for all of Michigan's public radio stations. Rick, thank you so much.
Oh, you bet, April. Thank you.
After the break, we explore the controversial life and legacy of Lewis Cass.
He was part of this move to put treaties together to try to get the indigenous peoples of Michigan to either leave their land entirely or to move to reservations.
We'll also hear from a former Cass Tech graduate on the possibility of renaming her alma mater. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. In recent weeks, Michigan's undergone a sea change in its thinking about one of the state's key historical figures. The state legislature has voted to rename the Lewis Cass Building in Lansing as the Elliott Larson Building. And there's been a lot of public debate whether Cass Tech in Detroit or Cass Avenue might be ripe for a rename as well. There are many other spots around the state bearing the name of Lewis Cass. We thought it was a good time to remember his legacy and why it's so problematic. The Michigan History Center's Rachel Clark joins us for some context. Hey, Rachel.
Hi.
So Lewis Cass ended his career with a long string of titles: territorial governor of Michigan, U.S. senator, aspiring presidential candidate, secretary of war under Andrew Jackson, executor of genocide. This man had a very long career. But where did he come from and how did he end up in Michigan?
He actually was from out east in New Hampshire, and his military career sort of brought him here. So he started buying up a lot of land in the Detroit area in the 1830s. And he was territorial governor, as you said, from 1813 to 1831. So his political career actually is what brought him here, and his military career. He came here early.
His tenure leading what we now know as Michigan, in this time he was responsible for negotiating treaties with Native people.
He was.
He also led an expedition through the region all the way up into present-day Minnesota. It sounds like he never quite gave up the idea of himself as a doer of things.
No, he had great ideas of what the territory of Michigan could become. And so he was partially responsible, he and a team, of essentially mapping out the early mapping out of Michigan. If you want to become a state and you want to get people to come here, you sort of have to let them know what the land looks like. So he was responsible for the mapping of the territory at that time.
How did his time as territorial governor shape the state in other political ways?
He, as Michigan, the territory, was starting to gain popularity, he was instrumental in essentially the removal of the indigenous peoples of Michigan. Michigan wasn't new at this. This had been going on in the eastern part of the country. But in the 1820s and 1830s, he was part of this move to put treaties together to try to get the indigenous peoples of Michigan to either leave their land entirely or to move to reservations. And starting in 1820s, essentially they started in the area of what is now Wayne County, Macomb County, and then just moved up through the state, developing these very loosely based treaties. So that was sort of his legacy, as getting Michigan to become a state, because as the indigenous people either moved to the reservations or were forced to leave, then other people could come in and buy that land.
His service under President Jackson coincides with one of the most awful chapters in the United States colonial relations with Native Americans. The Indian Removal Act was passed in 1830. Mm-hmm. What was Lewis Cass's role in enforcing that?
As he became the Secretary of War under Andrew Jackson, as I said, the treaties initially, the way they were written, allowed for the indigenous people of Michigan to stay as long as they stayed on what are now reservations. But the people who didn't do that, you have to understand the life of indigenous people, they didn't stay in one spot. They moved around a lot. And so for the indigenous people that would not go to the reservations, he forced them out militarily and was responsible for the removal and death of tens of thousands of indigenous people out of Michigan. So that was sort of his legacy as Secretary of War under Andrew Jackson. It wasn't just that time period. He had started it earlier, but because he was Secretary of War, he did have the military backing to force people out of the territory.
On top of all this, Lewis Cass was a slaveholder, was he not?
He was. Records indicate that he owned at least one slave when he was in Detroit. There's differing records of that ownership and what happened to that person. But yes, the records indicate he was a slave owner of at least one person.
Rachel, how did Michigan get to a place where someone who was so closely involved with really problematic parts of Michigan history and American history was so widely recognized as, you know, a father of the state?
I think time does interesting things to figures in history. So people argue today that he was a man of his time, and that is true. But as time went on and people looked at him as a historical figure, in the 1950s, he was revered. And as we look at him today, you know, people are really examining his role in the founding of our state, but also his role as a person who did force the indigenous people out of Michigan and was responsible for the death of indigenous people and the destruction of their culture.
The building in question in Lansing that was recently renamed, what was it called before it carried Lewis Cass's name?
It was simply called the State Office Building. It was the only one. So it was built in 1919. In 1921, it opened. And it was the only state office building that we had outside of the Capitol. So it was just called the State Office Building. And in 1951 and 52, funds were put together to build a second one. And so eventually it became time for it to have a different name.
Because there was more than one.
There was more than one. It did. And the concern was it was too confusing having this, the old state office building and the new state office building. So in 1952, the Michigan Historical Commission, actually, which is a predecessor to the Michigan History Center, where I work, members of the commission petitioned the legislature to name the two state office buildings. They petitioned what was known as the old state office building to be called the Lewis Cass Building, and the new state office building was to be called the Stephen C. Mason Building. That was approved in 1952, and both buildings opened up in 52. In 51, what is now the Elliott Larson Building had a devastating fire, and it was under reconstruction. So it opened back up in 52, along with the Stevens T. Mason Building.
Rachel, the figures in the National Statuary Hall collection, have these statues ever been reconsidered in, you know, a more modern light or reinterpreted before?
They have. In 2000, U.S. Congress gave states the ability to change out their statues. Up until that point, each state was allowed two statues at their own cost as a gift to the U.S. Capitol. So in 2000, it was decided that maybe it was a good idea to reconsider some of the statues. And eight states took them up on it initially, and Michigan was one of them, to replace one of our two statues that we had there.
Who were the other figures represented in the statues in years past? I mean, Lewis Cass was always a part of it. But whose statue was there before Gerald Ford's?
Zachariah Chandler's statue was there prior to Ford. His statue was placed there in and around 1913, so he was our second statue.
Who was he?
Zachariah Chandler is an interesting person. He was born in 1813 in New Hampshire, and rather than go to university, which was sort of expected of him, he moved to Detroit in 1833 to open a store. In 1851, he was elected mayor of Detroit, and that sort of started this very long political career that he had. So by 1857, he's elected U.S. Senator from Michigan. And in 1875, he is the Secretary of Interior under Ulysses S. Grant. And throughout his time, his tenure as Secretary of the Interior, he takes that opportunity to sort of fix a lot of the corruption that he saw in Washington that had been developing over the years, but especially during the era of the Civil War. So he cleaned up corruption in the Bureau of Indian Affairs, the Pension Bureau, Land Office, Patent Office, basically anywhere where he saw corruption or graft or laziness, he called for the removal of the people that were working in those departments and bureaus.
Do you think that the reconsideration of Lewis Cass that's going on right now will be limited to that? I mean, the closer we examine Michigan history, what else have we not been paying close enough attention to in how we tell our story?
I think that towns and cities and the state as a whole will start to look at the namesakes of their buildings or their streets or their whole town. You know, I live in a town that was named after Stevens T. Mason, who was also a slave owner. So it's a big process and it's a big conversation. But I think that those conversations are starting, and I think that it's definitely time to have them. You know, there was a reason that the Cass Building was named the Cass Building in 1952, but there's a reason it's being renamed. And I think those are all conversations to have. And I think it's just really important that those continue.
I wonder if you could give us sort of a historian's take on the fact that, you know, that there is this very public, very modern public conversation going on right now of how we talk about history and whether it is truly fixed in stone or something that we continue to interpret as we grow into the place that we're going to be.
Well, I think the word that you just used is important. You said interpret. And who's doing the interpreting, who's part of that conversation, and who's at the table is the most important thing. In the 1950s, when the Cass and the Mason buildings were named, there were a very particular people at the table at the time, and they were the ones in charge of interpreting the history. So I think that it's important that the conversation continues, but also reinterpreting history. There's always information out there. There's always new things being found, but there are also new eyes looking at it and new ways of thinking about it. I'm not a professional historian. I'm an educator by trade, but in the work that I do, just looking at history with new eyes and new thinking is always important. And that will continue. And in another 30 years, we'll look at everything again. And it's just really important to continue to do that and continue to have different and new and diverse people at that table as things are being looked at.
Rachel Clark at the Michigan History Center. Rachel, thanks for walking us through this.
Thank you so much for having me.
Flint Poet Laureate Samaj Brown has been thinking about the possible renaming of her alma mater, Cass Technical High School. She sent us this essay.
On the renaming of Cass Technical High School. But you must at least consider, please. If you are a graduate of Cass Tech, as I am, then you are a supposed enlightened thinker, certainly not a vestige of the past. You are one who has the capacity to redefine our reality. We CT grads are charged with the responsibility to innovate. Part of being a social sculptor is to embrace a social consciousness, to endure the hard swallow of loss and the tough triumph of transformation is the carving of history forward. I understand you and I and most were oblivious to the brutal and unforgivable history of our school's namesake. Lewis Cass was not only a flagrant segregationist, but a slaveholder and architect of the Trail of Tears Native American genocide. Arresting are these words I read. It seems we should be angry, not proud. We were duped for decades, calling and shouting the name of a mass murderer. Why didn't someone tell us? Why didn't I have the type of education fueled by curiosity that would lead me to question, to research, just natural inquisitiveness, the name of the school that made my heart beat green and white? Not one of us in the 4,000 among those 8 floors said, "Hey, CT, you look so good to me." But guess what? We carry the stained cloak of racism on book bags and on our lettered shirts. Oh, ignorance or innocence was not our fault. No, no fault of ours. We are absolved by age. We were young. But we are aware now, and we think with adult minds. We are responsible to not only our romanticized memories and sentimental platitudes, but we are responsible to the future. It is unconscionable to require next generation scholars to bloom genius under the toxicity of a name synonymous with the annihilation of their existence. The specialized education we received requires much from us. It is our charge to lead with new thought, to ensure all children are afforded the opportunities I pray were not squandered upon us. Identity. Yes, we must reckon with identity in the same manner we demanded the state of Mississippi reckon with its past and abandon the Confederate flag. Many Southerners say that flag is heritage. However, we know the Confederate flag is a symbol of white superiority. We know, and the world knows, symbolism, words, labels, and named edifices speak a megaphone of belief. Many technicians want to maintain the name as now it represents to us Black excellence, our pride, our legacy, our experiences translate into the identity of exceptionalism that we strive to maintain. After all, it is the antithesis of everything for which the namesake stood. Oh, we proved the beastly, soulless wrong. Just look at us. There arrives a time when this type of proving and validation seeking is obsolete. This is the time to redefine our identity in a more imaginative and expansive global manner. It is the time to reconnect our history, our Black excellence, Detroit experiences with the entire world community. If after deep contemplation and study, if after a panoramic viewing, a complete look at this African American driven movement happening right now with Black Lives Matter and allies, if after considering the 450-year chokehold of white supremacist systems, if after all that, technicians and alumni cannot shift and remake, and by remaking, redefine, and thus rename our true legacy into something larger, more connected, and powerful, then I fear Caztec did not fulfill those lauded ideals of excellence. For excellence is not stagnant. Excellence soars on the wings of time. The agenda of the day requires each of us to rise above the torrents of life and jubilantly throw off the cloak of racism and command an illuminated, evolved future. The renaming, the renaming should be celebration, not fraught with doubt and worry. We are stepping into a new cultural reality. Old paradigms are shifting. First, they shift, my friend, and then they fall.
That's Samaj Brown. She is the first poet laureate of the city of Flint on the renaming of Detroit's Caztec. Coming up, how to help older adults cope with the isolation of physical distancing. That's coming up after a break. You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. The coronavirus pandemic has cut many of us off from our normal social lives. No more big family dinners, no more after-work happy hours with your friends. And older adults who are at higher risk for deadly complications from the virus have to be especially vigilant about physical distancing. That isolation comes with its own mental and physical costs. Joining us to talk about those challenges and how we can address them is Jeffrey Hoffman. He's an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Nursing, where he specializes in researching the care of older adults. Jeffrey Hoffman, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
What have you been seeing about the ways that older adults are mentally affected by the shutdowns?
Yeah, I think there's tremendous concern out there of the effects on mental health from the social isolation due to the COVID situation. I think it's important to just sort of state right up front that the older adult population is extremely heterogeneous. We sort of provide this artificial threshold if you're over a certain age that you're an older adult, but there's tremendous variation in there. So to your point, to your question, there are people who live in assisted living facilities who may have, and other sort of congregate living facilities who may have other older adults around them. There are other people who sort of live on their own who are more socially isolated. There are variation just within people in the same settings who may feel more or less isolated. But I think it's fair to say in net that, this is a really big societal shift, and older adults already, many of them experience social isolation even in pre-COVID times. And this is sort of, put the gas pedal down and we're ramping up to 100 miles per hour. So there's tremendous concern, I think, as well. We need to recognize that traditional avenues of support that were once there, things such as family caregivers coming in to visit, whether someone's in a nursing home or other assisted living facility or just at home, those sorts of visits are now restricted. So, we have amongst the sort of gerontologist community lots of concern about what's going on.
Yeah. And as you say, some of us, our personalities may just change. We may, some of us become a lot more hypersocial as we age and some of us become way more introverted. Is interaction important for both kinds of people?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think, there's tremendous beauty in the heterogeneity of human life and personality and how we all address things. And as you say, things change over time. It's hard to know, but the sort of resources, the availability of sort of community activities for people who want to reach out and access those things, those have been tremendously clamped down. We've all experienced that ourselves, even those of us who aren't in the sort of older age categories, the big issue when it comes to aging is autonomy and independence. And so regardless of your specific sort of characterological type, whether you're more extroverted or introverted, I think, you know, everyone's feeling the push from this, but it's restricting all of our sort of avenues of independence. And so whether you choose to express your independence and autonomy through a more extroversion sort of centered means or not, all of us are being affected by this. So social loneliness and isolation, sort of loneliness being the subjectively felt experience of isolation, is going to hit us all in different ways. But I think it's on net, on average, affecting us all deeply is my take, yeah.
What kind of physical consequences might this mean for seniors if they do have unmet needs?
Yeah, this is another area where specifically with the research that I do a lot of work on injuries, specifically fall injuries. And I have actually tremendous concern that we could see some sort of disability epidemic that results from the COVID epidemic. And what I mean by that is that another sort of impactful consequence of isolation is we have what's called deconditioning. So we restrict our physical functioning, our physical activity. We become more sedentary. I think we've all, to some extent, experienced that, although I'll totally concede that, you know, my wife and I have done way more walking than we ever did before and whatnot. But I think it's true to the extent that we get out less, we engage less socially and physically, that this deconditioning can happen. That can affect cognitive and physical functioning. And when you have those deficits in play, it can lead to, you know, to disability, to falls, to fall injuries. So when you couple that with what's going on with the healthcare system, where we were seeing many fewer visits, less capacity in the healthcare system to address sort of your typical standard sort of care modalities and patterns, things like post-acute care and rehabilitation, outpatient settings after, you know, after hospitalizations or elective care, elective surgeries. There's reason for great concern that we're going to see sort of an upswelling of fall injuries in the older adult population.
Even as the healthcare system is struggling to deal with the costs and pressures of the pandemic. The conversations that people have with their families and friends can sometimes be frustrating right now. You know, a lot of folks are, if you ask them how they're doing, they're just inclined to say, I'm fine. You know, I'm getting by. It's not fun, but I'm hanging in there. How do you approach getting people to acknowledge that they don't have to settle for just getting by or just getting through this? And, you know, that may involve getting some help.
Yeah, that's a wonderful question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to that. You know, it's sort of the key question. I'll take a few swings at it. I mean, so again, harkening back to sort of my area of study of falls and fall injuries, it's sort of one of the fascinating aspects of it is that there's a tremendous reluctance on the part of many older adults to discuss what I think we could concede are sort of stigmatic issues that like loneliness, mental health, falls, risk, fears of falling. I think there are really good explanations and reasons for those fears and that sort of reluctance. But overcoming that and sort of how to figure out how to reach across is a little more tricky. I would hazard to say that probably one way that could gain some traction is just going back to this notion of autonomy and independence. We find that when we talk to older adults about physical activity and fall risk, for instance, again, recognizing that sort of the discussion of falls may not apply to everything we're talking about here, but when it comes to falls, if you talk about independence and autonomy and how to have sort of well-being and a good life as we age, that works a lot better than saying, sort of discussing things in a negative sense. Do you not have a fall risk? Do you not have a gait and stability problem? Do you not have muscle wastage or, you know, other sorts of issues? There's just greater responsiveness when you sort of put autonomy, recognition of the need for autonomy first, as opposed to you are a risk. I think societally, the broader issue is there's ageism involved, and we internalize that as we age as well. And so as a society, we tend to think of aging as a process where we become more and more disabled. We have less to contribute. Our roles and responsibilities are restricted. You know, and that's that's something that we apply to older adults when we're younger, and we possibly internalize as we age ourselves. And because of that, there's probably a reluctance to be stamped with that or sort of branded with that sort of weakness or fallibility when we become older. And so we just say we don't want to talk about it. That's sort of my what I surmise might be going on. But it's the million-dollar question, frankly, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jeffrey Hoffman. He's at the University of Michigan School of Nursing, and he's a PhD researcher who specializes in the care of older adults. I was reminded by Michigan radio reporter Will Callen's feature that most of Michigan seniors do, in fact, live at home. Do you think that fact is well understood when we talk about policies around elder care?
I think that's a really good point. There's a lot of sort of misunderstood reality about sort of aging and housing and the healthcare system and how it applies to older adults. I think there's probably an expectation that most of us will end up living in some sort of nursing home or assisted living facility when we age, and that's just not the case at all. You know, the specific numbers, I'm not sure if it's 10 or 15%, but it's not a tremendous amount. We will all at some point, about 40 to 50% of us, be in a nursing facility at some point, and that could simply mean after a hip surgery, we'll be in a nursing facility for a couple weeks for rehab or something like that. You know, my grandma had a spiral fracture when she was on a cruise when she was 95 years old, and I don't know if she was dancing or something, but she had a pretty bad spiral fracture, and she was the most optimistic person I've ever known, and she, you know, she just went into her assisted living facility's sort of step down or step up, I guess, skilled nursing facility for about a month and a half. And then she was better and moved back to her apartment and things were better. But largely speaking, we have a population of older adults that's growing tremendously, and they're mostly going to be living out in the community. And our healthcare system's tried to adapt to that to some extent. The Medicaid program has a bunch of waiver and demonstration programs that try to allow states to redirect spending out to community programs as opposed to just sort of medicalized, very expensive nursing home care, which can cost $200 a day. But I don't know that people are fully aware of that. And I think if they were, they might sort of in a political sense be more willing to allow more spending on those sorts of things.
And at the same time, we do have this whole population of folks who are quite literally trapped, you know, with away from the reach of their families, sometimes unable even to communicate with their families if they're in the grip of the virus. What are your concerns right now for folks who are living in, I think you said, congregate care?
Yeah, so I mean, there's these sort of technical terms of different sort of housing situations, but for people who are living in various forms of whether they're nursing homes or congregate care, you know, assisted living facility is a little bit different, but I think something that's worth keeping in mind is that we know, first of all, that that's where sort of the wildfire of COVID has been most impactful and scary. You know, there's been disproportionate caseload and massively disproportionate case fatality amongst nursing home residents. So I think 80% of all deaths so far, something like that, have been older adults in nursing facilities. And, you know, we've had all these problems with the protective equipment and whatnot, but we've also heard these sort of horrifically wrenching stories about family members unable to go visit. Medicare didn't allow sort of in-person visits. And, you know, I think what people may not recognize is that even someone living in a nursing facility, they still rely on family caregivers. And so family caregivers are sort of the unspoken component of how we're addressing older adult needs in this epidemic.
Family caregivers or in-home care services who make regular visits. So do you think that we're going to come to see assisted livings or other kinds of facilities in a different way because of this sort of recognizing that there are limits to the way we've been doing this?
I sure hope so. I think we feel that sort of in my research community, the policy community, that there's been some advancements over time, or what seem to be advancements in terms of Medicare creating star quality ratings for nursing home performance to sort of keep a handle on the type of care that older adults in those facilities are receiving. But we've seen during the epidemic, much as with all other sorts, all other parts of the healthcare sector, that there are big gaps in there. Some of the, I think in Washington State, where there was sort of a super spreader, you know, one of the epicenters of nursing home, lots of fatalities in the nursing home, that it had a high star rate in the Medicare system, you know. So needing to rethink oversight of these places, how we get staff to be safe and go in and be safe themselves as they're providing care. I think we're going to have to spend a lot of time rethinking and rejiggering these things. And I hope policymakers will do those things, as well as recognize again the need for, you know, reaching out to family caregivers and allowing them to be part of this process. I think there's tremendous undervaluing or devaluing of the family caregiver role, whether it's helping patients with dementia who have been hospitalized with COVID, or other older individuals with other sorts of limitations, not having a family caregiver there to help with shared decision making or palliative care or end of life, seeing them as family members are at the end of life. These have been really wrenching things, and we need policy solutions for them.
We're at this point in the pandemic now where we're far from the end of the road. How do you think, what might be a healthy way to think about the physical isolation that may still be necessary going forward?
I think even I ask myself that question sometimes. Mm-hmm. Here's something that I've been thinking about. You know, I would think that this epidemic presents us all with opportunities for sort of growth and improvement, whether it's the healthcare system sort of pointing out the pre-existing sort of gaps or piecemeal application of policies as opposed to sort of really carefully thought through holistic policies. You know, the one of the big takeaways from all this is social capital, that how do we function as communities? How do we make sure that we prioritize our older individuals in our communities, whether locally or nationally? I think we're starting to recognize that there are tremendous disparities in terms of the different amounts of support that different older adults and communities are getting or providing. And maybe what we could do is think, you know, all of us, whether old or young, are experiencing loss of autonomy and independence right now, right? Like restrictions on our ability to feel that we're in control of things. And, you know, everything takes much longer to do, whether it's shopping and cleaning your groceries afterwards or whatnot. And to some extent, that might be a way to sort of empathize, find a way through to see what the aging process is like to some extent, where some of that encroachment of loss of autonomy comes to bear and things take longer to do. And I think if we can do that, we can sort of humanize the situation. What I would love to see come out of this is a greater, deeper, richer understanding of and appreciation of the older adult community, and sort of a nationally mobilized effort, whether it's intergenerational supports, taking all these young individuals who may not be on college campuses and have extra time, or people who, you know, musicians, artists, people who have lost work in the sort of economic issues we've had, to make phone calls, play music for older adults, like really like walk the walk and not just talk the talk. Like, how can we rebuild social capital? So my most optimistic take on all this is, a healthy way to think about this is, gosh, you know, we've all Zoomed more than we ever have with family before. You know, there are really positive things. I've spent more time with my family in enriching, wonderful ways than ever before. Let's do that intergenerationally. Let's reach out to older adults. Let's support them technologically, et cetera.
Jeffrey Hoffman is an assistant professor at the University of Michigan School of Nursing. Thank you so much for your thoughts on this. And we know you have a new arrival in the family, so congratulations on that as well.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure and a privilege speaking with you, April. Thanks so much.
We got a note from a listener this week about tax bills. If you live in Marion Township in Livingston County, you may have noticed that on the back of your tax bill, a notice was placed suggesting that folks maybe should try a method besides paying in person, maybe using a Dropbox or mailing it in because of the pandemic. Except the notice doesn't just call it a pandemic. It refers to the Wuhan COVID virus. As our listener points out, that's not a phrase that doctors use. A lot of major media outlets don't use it either, since there have been a number of incidents in this country in which Asian Americans have been attacked or verbally abused by people who associate them with COVID. The U.S. State Department recently pushed to have the term included in a G7 statement on the pandemic. Other foreign ministers in the group rejected the idea. The Marion Township treasurer declined to talk to us on the record, but confirmed he did write the copy. And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. See you tomorrow.